Susan, a fantastic event. I wanted to ask a question of the medical students. Something I didn't mention in my introduction, and it's the financial path. You know, medical students, when I was graduating, were not leaving medical school with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. And I was wondering if you guys are detecting or feeling within yourselves and your colleagues whether financial decisions based on the cost of medical education are playing a role in your decisions for the future.
I'll take that first. That's an incredibly good question. I mean, the cost of education in general is just skyrocketing, not even just for med school. I mean, I went to a state school where obviously a lot of people were deeply appreciative of in-state tuition. But I think as to whether or not it's playing a role, I think all of us are willing to accept that compensation rates, regardless of our fields, will probably end up going significantly down if we really want to cut into medical costs. Obviously, there's the pull to go into primary care, and I think we have to start compensating that field with its due deserts, considering all the incredible work that primary care physicians put into keeping patients safe and healthy in the first place. But myself personally, I think that it hasn't, at least on a conscious level, affected my decision to go into any one particular field. And again, I can be swayed in any one direction. But I think when you have to spend your entire life doing something and you're going to do your utmost to make sure that's something you really, really enjoy, regardless as to whether or not the compensation is what you would hope it would be. And of course, medicine is a challenging field, and you hope that you'll be adequately rewarded for all your efforts in it. But I think a lot of people choose to go into medicine for fairly altruistic reasons in the first place, and I would like to hope that that doesn't end when we're looking at our specialties.
Hi. I think it's, you ask a really generous question, because I think something that I learned through this radio program is how under the radar medical students and their lives and the process that they go through, how it's our lives, so we know the ins and outs, but for the most part, people really only see doctors. And when we walk into a room, because we're wearing a white coat, people assume that we're doctors. And even if we say medical student, it doesn't often really, it isn't really understood, the distinction between a doctor and a medical student. And I think it's a big process to get here, and it is challenging, and there are personal sacrifices that you make, and those look different to different people in terms of loans that you take out and financial burdens for paying for lifestyles and for school. And I think you'd be hard pressed to find a medical student to whom that wasn't something that wasn't a consideration. And I don't really know what exists out there that will change the burden, the financial burden that exists now for what education, for the cost of education. But I think it is something that weighs on our minds and definitely impacts what you hope your life looks like after school. And I think it affects dreams that students have when they come into school. And I don't know that I actually understood that, how big that was, until I got here. And I forget who mentioned earlier that, you know, the diversity of the students at Brown is just that. It's exceptionally diverse. And I think, you know, people find creative ways, people get scholarships, but for the most part, it's quite frightening how much money is involved. And I think I thank you for asking the question, just because it increases the awareness of the fact that this exists for us, and that it's a challenge, and that none of us, I think, have an answer to it. Yeah.
I have another question right here.
So thank you very much for it. It was a wonderful and very, very interesting discussion. I had a question for Paul, and, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and the first thing I want to ask you is, if you think that the way physicians are paid affects the way that they think and they practice, and if you think that it does, and we want this paradigm shift in the way that physicians are paid, who's going to teach this new generation of medical students to think in a different way? Because we who are the old teachers of medicine, have been educated in a completely different paradigm.
Sure. So let me answer your question with somewhat of an anecdote. So when I was a medical student, I was a medical student here at Brown and was a resident. I was a resident here at Brown. When I was rounding, cost never came into consideration when we were ordering tests. So every day we would order, you know, a complete blood count on a patient and a Chem-7 on a patient, which is electrolytes, basically. It was just reflexive that we would do it. And I don't believe ever having once a conversation about how much that cost. And now, I graduated from residency 5 years ago. So now as an attending on rounds, I don't even bring it up. The residents bring it up and the medical students bring it up. And they say to me, do you think we really need that CBC? Do you really think we need that Chem-7? And they're calling the lab and finding out how much those things cost. And so they're telling me, you know, yeah, if you order a potassium and a sodium alone, it's like X number of dollars. But if you order the Chem-7, it's, you know, X number of dollars more. And we really just need the sodium and the potassium. We don't really need the BUN and creatinine. So it really is coming into play with learners now. There's not a formal curriculum for it. It's not something that we've done explicitly, but it's something I think that we need to do more of moving forward. And I think the ACO model is, one way. So, you know, docs are going to get paid based on not only their quality, but also on the cost of care they give. And, you know, if they're ordering unnecessary tests or redundant tests, they're going to get paid less. And so, I said earlier assessment drives learning, but I also think getting paid drives learning.
One of the things you're saying that who's really reshaping the education, it's not coming from the top down necessarily, but the bottom up.
Sure, I think there's many forces reshaping medical education.
So in listening to that story, one of my big worries, I guess, is that people just think about the cost. I mean, what we have to do is link cost and quality and go, okay, this money is worth spending because this is the outcome we get, as opposed to something we're spending where we don't see a noticeable outcome. That's the link that I think is so important. And I don't think we always even have that information, because we haven't until recently been trying to tie those two things together. So there's a lot of work we're going to need to do to get it right.
It's very difficult to find out what things cost in a really basic way. Speaking as a reporter, speaking as a patient, there's not a lot of transparency, but that's changing, right?
Well, so we're off the air, right?
Yes.
So
this is off the air.
We're actually,
speak freely.
There is a bill right now in the legislature to push transparency in. I mean, you can even mention it, but there is a bill to push transparency. And it has a number of other features. And I believe that portion has already been removed from the bill because there is not a willingness to agree on how to do that.
Miller's bill?
Yes, Josh Miller's bill. That is a fundamental issue that we need to grapple with, because that's important. Actually, I think it's important. I would bet that a lot of we'll leave the patients out of this discussion for now. I think a lot of physicians and other health professionals have no idea what things cost. Yeah. And it's not that it should be the deciding factor, but it is a relevant factor. Yeah. And certainly if we're talking about patient compliance in the community, if you discover that there are two options, one is absolutely unaffordable to the patient and one is not, that's an important piece of information, and you often don't have it.
Thank you. Let's take another question right here.
In the course of the discussion today, starting with the fascinating presentation of Dr. Aronson of what it was like, I wonder what education, the medical education, does or doesn't do about the enormous increase in patient awareness. Education, Google, WebMD, and the likes. Now, from what little I know about it, particularly in private conversation with physician friends or acquaintances, the entire interaction, the entire discussion between patient and physician has changed very dramatically. Now, I am not aware of whether the yes or no, as I said a moment ago, there is an effect of these developments, evolutions, on the education. Are the students prepared now, when they confront the real world, to handle well-educated, sometimes over-educated, for some purposes, but always inquisitive, always, if I may say, even occasionally talking back, and analyzing and scrutinizing every word the physician presents them with. Thank you.
Do you want to take a stab at that first?
Sure. Paul? So the answer is yes, but not as good as we should be doing it. So, you know, for example, we've now introduced the electronic medical record into the training of both preclinical medical students and clinical medical students. And so, and one of the things that we're teaching our students to do, and Peter and Sarah didn't do this, it's more for our senior level students, is communicating information found on the web to patients. So we're asking our students to pull up WebMD or pull up MD Consult or other websites and actually go over the information on those sites with patients. And that's something I'll actually do in practice. Like, a patient will come in and say, hey, doc, you know, I found this on WebMD. And so I'll pull it up and we'll go over it together in the room. And we're trying to teach our students how to do that. But it's something that's been done poorly across medical schools in general, and it's one of the things that Brown's on the cutting edge of. We actually just got a paper accepted on teaching students how to do that to one of the largest med-ed journals in the country. So.
Thank you for that question. Do you have a quick response before we go to another question?
I mean, we haven't formally reached that point in the curriculum, but I've seen my mentors actually just do just that, sit down with patients, and that sort of mentorship sort of, you know, of course, pushes on us to sort of be able to respond to patients in the same way.
We have another question here, and we may have time for one more after that. Go ahead.
I will address this with Paul, I guess. Harvard Medical School hear about the engineering school not moving into the Jewel District.
Sure. So, I'm not sure the medical school has thought much about it. I think it's disappointing that it's not going to be down here. I think that there's a lot of opportunities for collaboration between the School of Engineering and the School of Medicine. I think that we're equally disappointed, and I'm speaking for myself and not for the medical school, that we can't get a School of Nursing to move into the Jewelry District. I think that was something that was in the state legislature or was up for a vote and didn't happen, and I think it would be wonderful to get the URI nursing students and the RIC nursing students up here in the Knowledge District so that we can do more co-teaching and co-learning.
Lieutenant Governor, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, the only other thing I'll add, and somewhat in defense of Brown's decision, is that the engineering program at Brown is largely an undergraduate program, so I understand that decision. I think it would be sad if it rules out other types of collaboration that can happen on a project basis or on a graduate level, but I think it's tough to put an undergraduate program so far removed, so I have some understanding. I absolutely agree about the nursing building. I still have hope, and I'm encouraged, for example, about the meetings that have been going on about the primary care track, that those programs are both represented, and I'm hopeful that we will, and CCRI as well, actually. They all are training nurses in our community, and it would be great to have them closer to their clinical training sites and closer to the physician clinical training.
30 seconds. There's been some talk of trying to bring a shared nursing school to this very neighborhood, and it's sort of hit the skids, that plan, a little bit for various reasons. But as you can see, there's a lot of interest in making that happen. Okay, let's have our two final questions here. So please.
I've seen a trend in some primary care practices for a nurse practitioner to be a little bit of a gatekeeper, where there's limited access to the physician. And I was wondering, for anyone who can answer, how you see that playing out in the future?
I mean, I think it goes back to the team model. Lieutenant Governor Roberts mentioned that there's going to be 110,000 new patients potentially with health insurance who didn't have health insurance before. I don't think that there's enough primary care physicians to take care of those patients solely. And so I think that it's important for primary care physicians to work in conjunction with other health professionals, such as nurse practitioners, such as physician assistants, in taking care of patients. So really, that's one of the things that we're trying to do is with our students is to try to teach a team approach. And, you know, I would view a physician and a nurse practitioner or a PA as a team taking care of a panel of patients as opposed to, you know, more of a gatekeeper type model.
So I'm going to do it because I'm not a professional in their field, so I'm going to use anecdote. So the teams that we've had for a long time are in pediatricians' offices. They've been running it. My children, who are now not children, barely, probably didn't see the doctor for the last 6 or 7 years they were in the practice because they didn't have an illness that required it. But the times that they had, they always saw the physician. That was an ideal situation for them because they had a very strong relationship and they were very comfortable with the nurse practitioner. And I knew if I needed that we could see the doctor. So I didn't see it as a gatekeeper as much as a really smart way to manage the practice. I knew the nurse practitioner had more time to spend with my kids and it worked really well. So I one of the things I want to be really careful that we don't do as we think about in our kind of planning process is that this is really about partnerships with patients and within the teams, not kind of a gatekeeping, triaging function. And I think we have to be really cautious because if it's perceived that way, people should resist it.
Yeah. Thank you for that question. One last question, please.
Thank you all for a very stimulating discussion, especially with students. There are people in the community who can teach from other vantage points. I spent the first part of my career with Kaiser Permanente and really learned very quickly the importance of treating patients in efficacious and cost-efficacious ways. And there was a joke after the first year or so of being a newly hired physician at Kaiser, who became Kaiserized. We really thought about the test rule ordering, and there were people that came around and said, do you really want to treat this brand-name drug when this generic drug costs us about 15% of the cost? So there are people in the community who can help, and I think we're in the state on the cusp of that, with a big healthcare systems such as Lifespan beginning the process of hiring physicians so we become hospital-based instead of community-based and private practice incentivized to do more tests. But one of the really important things that this system, these integrated systems have is this linkage of everybody in the collaborative care model electronically. And as well as the lab system and the pharmacy information system, and everybody's linked. Inpatient and outpatient, it's bridged. And so we have such fragmentation of care here in the state. And I'm hoping that if there is extra monies and funding for some of these projects that Lieutenant Governor talked about, that we can talk about even linking the safety net of community clinics. They all have electronic records, but believe it or not, they are all different records so that we can't create large registries and disease registries. This is the first step to really mining the data and seeing who's falling through the cracks and how to go ahead and bring these people. And that's the first step in population health.
Is there a question that you wanted to ask or just to make a comment?
We can extend the safety net first of these clinics and do more electronic linkage and then move up from there. Again, these folks are the ones that have the biggest disparities, and this is where most of the clinical events, I'm a cardiologist, but this is where most of the clinical events will come. People who are out there and not getting their cholesterols checked and their diabetes treated, et cetera.
Thank you for your comment. Do you have a response?
Yeah, so it is correct, actually, and I would say that the health centers had their medical records in place before a lot of other practices in our state. But we have a number, as you described. Lifespan has its own system. The health centers run on two different systems, I think. And they're one of our big investments that's going on with federal money right now is creating that linked system. So it's called Current Care in Rhode Island. It is an opt-in system. Everyone who has an electronic health record is not automatically in it. You need to enroll. And there, at this point, I think are close to 300,000 Rhode Islanders who are in it. The technology only allows the sharing of our lab and maybe our imaging data right now. Can anybody tell me? So we are working on improving that. Part of that is built on the strong participation of all of the partners who have already invested in their information technology systems. But we are creating, as I like to say, when we all got our ATM cards and then that little Cirrus sticker showed up, right? So we could go anywhere with a Cirrus sticker and stick our card in and we would know how much money was in the bank. We are creating that system. It needs leadership from all of the providers as well as funding from the federal government, and we will keep pushing it. I hope within not too many more years what you describe will happen, because not only should we have clinically integrated systems, my information should follow me through whatever door I walk through in Rhode Island and help to manage my care.
Thank you. Oh, go ahead.
Just one thing that's amusing, just as a response to what you're saying. So something that I learned this year that of the software in the emergency room systems in Rhode Island that have electronic records is that there was no framework for the software that could manage what the patient load that was coming into emergency rooms. And the only thing that came close to serving such a high volume of people was software for restaurant chains. So actually that was the framework that they used to build the software for the emergency rooms, so that when doctors or med students or PAs or nurses look at the computer screen and they see, you know, a test tube blinking and they know that someone needs their labs checked, you know, in a restaurant, it was based on a restaurant where, you know, a drink would be blinking and it would be, you know, that table needed drinks and now it's a patient bed that needs labs. And so I think something that came to mind when you were speaking is that, you know, I think no one really saw the immediate need of what we need now, which is this uniform software that people can take with them wherever they go, or that, you know, can be cross-referenced between clinics and offices and hospitals. And I think there's definitely a need, and we see it definitely. But it's amusing what exists now and how people innovated to just create what there was a need for, but that there is something greater that has to be supplied, and I don't know where that comes from.
And commitment.
I would like to wrap it up there. Thank you for your questions. Please give my incredible panelists a round of applause. Thank you all so much for coming. Thank you to the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. Have a great night.
Thank you very much.
When is this on? This will be airing again Sunday. I believe it's 11 a.m. Where's my news director? It'll be available on the air and on our website at ripr.org.